Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are diving into a topic that, let's be honest, can sound pretty intimidating for a lot of people. Literary theory.
Yeah, just the name itself conjures up images of, you know, dusty libraries and really dense academic jargon.
Exactly. And that perception that it's all abstract, maybe irrelevant just for academics, that's precisely what our source material today wants to challenge.
We're looking at Key Concepts in Literary Theory by Julian Wolfries, Ruth Robbins, and Kenneth Womack. It's a really comprehensive guide.
And their core argument, which is sort of our mission for this deep dive too, is actually quite simple. Literary theory isn't about memorizing names and dates. It's an essential toolkit.
A practical toolkit. Think of it like getting a software upgrade for how you analyze the world around you.
Right. Because we're not just reading novels or watching movies anymore, are we? We're constantly swimming in cultural texts. Everything from news articles and ads to, you know, TikTok trends.
And theoretical literacy gives you the lenses, the tools to see how these things construct meaning, how they shape our understanding, how they wield power. It's not just about what they say.
So the shift is from passively consuming, just taking in the story, to actively participating, asking, how does this work? How does it persuade me or position me?
Mm-hmm. It's like knowing how to tell time versus being able to actually open the watch and see how the gears mesh together. You understand the mechanism of meaning.
Okay, so let's talk about the people who put this toolkit together. Julian Wolfries, Ruth Robbins, Kenneth Womack. Why are they the right team for this? Making the complex simple isn't easy.
Well, I think their combined expertise is really the key here. You've got Julian Wolfries, who is a specialist in some of the, let's say, trickier areas like post-structuralism.
He makes construction stuff.
Yeah, the stuff that often makes people's eyes glaze over. But he's known for making complex thinkers like Jacques Derrida much more accessible.
Okay, that's crucial. And Ruth Robbins.
Ruth Robbins brings in the focus on gender studies, feminist theory, identity politics. That's vital because it ensures the theory doesn't just stay in abstract philosophy land. It connects directly to, you know, real world social and cultural issues, power dynamics.
Right. Grounding it in lived experience. And Kenneth Womack, he seems like an interesting addition.
He really is. His work often bridges high theory and popular culture. I mean, he's written extensively on the Beatles.
The Beatles.
Wow.
Okay, so that immediately signals that this isn't just for analyzing, I don't know, Milton or Shakespeare.
Exactly. It shows the versatility. These theoretical tools can be used on a pop song, a blockbuster film, a Netflix series, anything really.
So the combination of their backgrounds, the deep theory, the social context, the pop culture application, means they've likely encountered and addressed pretty much every confusion a student might have.
Yeah, they understand the common hurdles, the jargon that trips people up. It makes the guide feel balanced and, importantly, pedagogical. It's designed to teach.
Which brings us nicely to how the book itself is structured. It's not a history book marching you through theory chronologically.
No, not at all. It's set up more like an A to Z glossary or maybe an encyclopedia of concepts. You can just jump in wherever you want.
I actually find that really helpful because in practice, you don't always use theory in a strict historical order, do you? You grab the concept you need.
Precisely. You might be reading something and think, this feels like it's about power and consent. So you look up, say, hegemony.
And the entry would probably link you to other related ideas.
Right. It'll point you towards ideology, maybe Marxism. It lets you build this web of understanding organically, kind of mimicking how critical thinking actually works. You pull different ideas together.
And the scope is huge, yeah. Right? It covers the absolute basics.
Yeah, like defining the author, the text, the canon things we often take for granted.
All the way through to the big movements like structuralism, post-structuralism.
Psychoanalytic theory, Freud, Lacan, and then the really socio-political stuff like feminist, Marxist, and post-colonial theory. It's incredibly broad.
Okay, let's dig into some of those core concepts then. Where do they suggest we start? Often it's by questioning the fundamentals, isn't it?
Absolutely. They start right at the foundation, the author.
Ah, yes. Roland Barthes and the Death of the Author. That phrase sounds so dramatic. What's the core idea there? Why kill the author?
Well, it's about shifting interpretive authority. If the author's intention isn't the ultimate goal, if the author is metaphorically dead, then you, the reader, aren't burdened with figuring out what some person, maybe centuries ago, intended to say.
So the focus moves away from biography and intention.
And lands squarely on the text itself. What does the text do? How does it operate? And crucially, what does it mean to you reading it now in your specific context? It liberates the text, gives it potentially infinite meanings.
That makes sense. It takes the pressure off finding the one true meaning. They also tackle the canon, right? The list of supposedly great works.
Mm-hmm. They push back against the idea that the canon is some kind of timeless, objective list of the best literature ever written.
It's more of a construct.
Exactly. It's presented as a selection that's deeply shaped by history, by politics, by power. The book encourages you to ask, who decided what got on this list? Whose values are represented, and importantly, whose voices were left out.
So questioning why, for instance, it took so long for works by women or writers from colonized nations to be included.
Precisely. It reveals the canon as a site of struggle, not just a neutral collection.
Okay, let's move to what feels like a real turning point. Structuralism. This seems foundational for so much that follows. Saussure and language.
It really is a revolutionary moment. The core insight comes from linguistics, from Ferdinand de Saussure. He looked at the basic unit of language, the sign.
And he breaks that down.
Yes, into two parts. The signifier, which is the word or the sound itself, like the letters T-R-E-E, or the sound of the word tree.
Okay.
And the signified, which is the concept, the mental image of the tree that pops into your head.
Right. Signifier, the word, signified the idea. What's the revolutionary part?
The crucial step is realizing that the link between the signifier and the signified is completely arbitrary. There's nothing inherently tree-like about the sound tree. It's just a convention.
We just agree that sound means that concept. It could have been blicket.
Exactly. We only know what tree means because it's not bush or rock or cloud. Meaning arises from the differences between signs within the overall system of language, what Saussure called lang.
Wow. Okay, so language isn't just like sticking labels onto a pre-existing reality.
No. It's more like language structures our reality. It's a self-contained system that generates meaning through internal relationships and differences. That's a huge shift.
It really is. So if meaning is arbitrary and based on difference within a system, that sounds potentially unstable. Where does post-structuralism take that idea, Derrida?
You've hit it exactly. If the sign is arbitrary, then meaning can't be permanently fixed. It's always slippery, always potentially shifting. Post-structuralists like Jacques Derrida pick up on this inherent instability.
And that leads to deconstruction.
Yes. Deconstruction isn't about destroying a text. It's more like a method of reading very, very closely to expose the internal contradictions, the hidden assumptions, the places where a text unintentionally undermines its own arguments or relies on unstated hierarchies.
Like finding the loose threads in the fabric of the text.
That's a good way to put it.
Mm.
It looks for things like logocentrism, the tendency to privilege speech over writing, or presence over absence. Assuming there's some ultimate stable meaning or truth the language is trying to capture, deconstruction shows that's often an illusion.
And what about difference? That's Derrida's term, famously hard to pin down. It sounds like difference, but with an A.
It is. It's a clever coinage. It plays on the French word différer, which means both to differ and to defer.
Okay.
So difference captures two ideas at once. First, meaning is created through difference, like Saussure said. Dog is not cat. Second, meaning is always deferred, always postponed. Any attempt to define a word just leads you to more words.
Like looking up a word in the dictionary and the definition uses other words you might have to look up and so on.
Exactly. You never arrive at some final solid bedrock of meaning that exists outside the system of language. It's always deferred down the chain of signifiers. Interpretation becomes this potentially endless dynamic process.
That feels quite philosophical, maybe even dizzying.
Yeah.
How does the book connect these ideas about unstable language back to, you know, the real world, politics, power?
That's where the sociopolitical lenses become so powerful. They take these insights about how meaning and reality are constructed and apply them to social structures. Take Marxist criticism.
Okay. Focusing on class and economics.
Right. Marxist critics analyze literature to see how it reflects, reinforces, or maybe even challenges the economic base of society, the class relations, the means of production. And a key concept here is ideology.
Which isn't just a political belief system, right? It's deeper than that in theory.
Much deeper. As the book explains it, ideology refers to the pervasive, often invisible, web of beliefs, values, and assumptions that makes the current social order, including its inequalities and power structures, seem natural, inevitable, or simply the way things are.
Common sense.
Exactly. Common sense is often ideology working its magic. So a Marxist reading might look at how a novel portrays wealth, poverty, labor, and class mobility. Does it make the system look fair? Does it expose exploitation? Does it reinforce the ruling class's ideology?
I see. The text becomes a site where these ideological battles are fought, and this connection between texts and power seems even clearer in post-colonial theory.
Absolutely. Drawing heavily on thinkers like Edward Said and his work on Orientalism, post-colonial theory examines the immense legacy of colonialism and imperialism, specifically how literature and culture were used to justify and maintain colonial rule.
How do they do that?
By constructing the image of the colonized people in Asia, Africa, the Middle East as the other, portraying them as exotic, backward, irrational, maybe dangerous, fundamentally different from and inferior to the Western colonizer.
Which then makes colonizing them seem like a civilizing mission or even necessary.
Precisely. So a seemingly innocent adventure story set in the exotic East or a poem about the Dark Continent suddenly isn't just entertainment. It's potentially part of the ideological machinery of empire. It links texts directly to systems of power and subjugation.
That really drives home the point that critical reading isn't just an academic game. It has real political dimensions.
Definitely.
Okay, stepping back from the specific theories for a moment, if you had to pull out, say, three big overarching messages that run through all these different approaches in the book, what would they be?
Okay. Three key themes. First, I'd say, is the profound shift initiated by the death of the author and the rise of the reader.
The empowerment idea we talked about earlier.
Yes. The core message is, stop worrying about finding the single correct interpretation the author supposedly intended. Instead, theory equips you to ask powerful questions. How does this text work? What structures does it use? What does it mean to me in my context now? It puts you in the driver's seat.
That feels very liberating, actually. Takes the anxiety out of it.
Right?
What's the second thing?
The second is the insistence on the political nature of literature and culture. Texts are never created in a vacuum.
They're not just art for art's sake.
Right. They are always products of and participants in the culture that produced them. They're embedded in specific historical moments, class structures, gender dynamics, racial politics, power struggles. So reading critically is engaging with these political dimensions, whether the text seems overtly political or not.
And the third theme?
I think it's the overarching pedagogical goal, presenting theory as a set of lenses or a toolkit.
Not as a rigid dogma you have to subscribe to.
Exactly. The book makes it clear that these theories aren't mutually exclusive religions you have to choose between. There are different sets of questions, different analytical frameworks you can pick up and use.
So you might use a Marxist lens one day to look at class in a film.
And then maybe a feminist lens the next day to analyze its portrayal of gender. Or a post-colonial lens to examine its assumptions about race and nation. The goal is to have a diverse toolkit that allows for richer, more nuanced interpretations from multiple angles.
That makes theory seem much less like a weapon and more like, well, a set of useful instruments.
That's the idea.
The book seems really good at boiling these big ideas down. You mentioned it's like a reference guide. Are there any sort of core ideas presented, almost like quotes, that really capture the essence?
Yeah, while it's more about explaining concepts, certain core philosophies shine through. They really emphasize the practical function of theory.
Okay, like what's...
Well, there's this idea about the toolkit itself. Something like, literary theory is not a master key that will unlock a single hidden meaning. Instead, it is a diverse toolkit that provides different sets of questions.
I like that. It emphasizes inquiry over answers. Opening things up, not shutting them down.
Exactly. And then there's the point about texts and culture. A literary text is never an innocent object of aesthetic beauty. It is always a participant in the culture that produced it.
A reminder that context and critique are always necessary, even when we're just appreciating something.
Mm-hmm. And finally, maybe my favorite, summing up the whole practice. The value of theoretical literacy lies not in applying formulas, but in developing the ability to ask productive questions about literature and culture.
So the skill is learning to ask better questions, not just applying theory X to text Y.
Precisely. It's about cultivating a critical habit of mind.
Okay, this is the crucial bit for many listeners, I think. How does knowing about, say, deconstruction or ideology actually apply to everyday life, outside of writing an essay?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? But the applications are everywhere once you start looking. Let's take application one, enhanced media literacy.
Okay, so watching TV, scrolling social media.
Exactly. Think about a popular reality TV show about wealthy families. You could apply a Marxist lens. How is wealth portrayed? Is it aspirational, critical? Mm-hmm. How is labor, or the lack of it, represented? Who benefits from this portrayal?
Or post-colonial lens on news coverage. How are foreign countries or conflicts framed? Who gets to speak? Are stereotypes being reinforced?
Right. Suddenly, you're not just consuming media. You're analyzing its underlying messages and power dynamics.
Okay. What's another application?
Application two. Understanding power dynamics in everyday situations. Think about Michel Foucault's concept of discourse.
Discourse as more than just conversation.
Yeah, discourse is a system of language, knowledge, and practice that shapes what can be thought, said, and done within a particular field like medicine, law, or even business management.
So looking at corporate jargon, for example.
Perfect example. Analyzing that jargon isn't just about weird words. It's about seeing how that specific language, that discourse establishes authority, excludes certain perspectives, and makes particular actions seem logical or necessary. Identifying the discourse is identifying how power operates subtly through language.
That's really insightful. One more.
Okay. Application three, gaining insight into personal identity. Theories from feminism, queer theory, psychoanalysis offer powerful tools here. Take Judith Butler's concept of performativity.
The idea that identity isn't something fixed inside us, but something we do.
Sort of, yeah. It suggests that gender, for example, isn't an internal essence, but a set of repeated actions, gestures, and styles performed according to available cultural scripts. We do gender rather than simply are a gender.
So you could use that to analyze, say, how social media pressures us to perform certain versions of ourselves, the perfect parent, the successful professional, the ideal partner.
Absolutely. It helps you see identity as more fluid, more constructed, and perhaps less burdensome than a fixed essence you have to live up to. It opens up space for understanding yourself and others differently.
Wow. So these tools really do extend far beyond the literature classroom.
They really do. The ultimate takeaway is that almost everything can be read as a text, an advertisement, a political speech, a family dinner conversation, your own feelings. Theory gives you the tools to analyze it all more deeply.
What was the most surprising or resonant thing for you working through this material?
For me, I think it was being reminded how liberating the idea of unstable meaning actually is. It sounds scary at first, like the ground is shifting beneath your feet.
Yeah, like if there's no stable meaning, what's the point?
But actually, it's the opposite. It means the conversation is never over. New readings are always possible. Texts stay alive because they can mean different things to different people at different times. That instability is the source of richness, not a lack.
That's a great way to look at it. It removes the anxiety of needing to find the final answer.
Mm-hmm. The lasting lesson, I think, is that developing theoretical literacy transforms you. You become a more perceptive reader of the world, not just of books. More analytical, more critical, more engaged.
A more conscious participant in culture, maybe.
I think so.
Okay, so let's leave our listeners with a final provocative thought, something to chew on based on what we've discussed.
How about this? Think about the concept of hegemony. That idea from thinkers like Gramsci, that power is often maintained not just by force, but by winning the consent of those who are governed, often by making the dominant group's worldview seem like natural common sense.
Right, getting people to buy into the system that might not even serve their best interest.
Exactly. So the provocation is, take a look at your own life this week. What ideas or situations do you currently accept as just common sense or the way things are? It could be about work culture, family roles, ideas about success, anything. Then ask yourself, could this common sense actually be a form of hegemony? Whose interests does it serve? And what theoretical concepts, maybe from Marxism about ideology or feminism about gender roles or post-structuralism about challenging binaries, could you use to question that assumption? Start looking for the theoretical tools to challenge your own common sense.
That's a fantastic challenge. Really puts the toolkit into practice.
Mm-hmm.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.